chaos and anger have erupted over the death of George Floyd.
There are hundreds of other examples of Black Americans being unjustly killed.
In many states, Black Americans in particular are dying at double the rate of their population.
The U.S. may now be at a boiling point.
You're listening to World Affairs. I'm Philip Yun. COVID-19, a crashing economy, and now outrage and protest in our cities. This moment feels like a paradigm shift, right? Our country is reckoning with its racist legacy. Who does our system serve, and who does it not? And maybe there's an opening for real change here at home. But there's also an opportunity for foreign actors to exploit our deep political divisions.
When we become pitted against each other and we can't see past parties and divides, we become fragile, we become brittle. There's a spotlight being cast very harshly on the United States and the state of race relations and the treatment of minorities and the inequalities in our society. The larger message from this is that if we don't want Russia and others to exploit this, we have to deal with it ourselves.
That's Fiona Hill. She was top Russia advisor under three presidents. You might remember her unflinching testimony during President Trump's impeachment hearing.
The unfortunate truth is that Russia was the foreign power that systematically attacked our democratic institutions in 2016.
Hill says that Russia, which is also dealing with a severe coronavirus outbreak, is poised to meddle in the 2020 election as well. She talked with KQED's Mina Kim on June 1st.
Fiona Hill, it's very good to talk with you.
It's great to be here, Mina. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you know, before the pandemic grabbed so much of the U.S.'s attention, I'm thinking of the reports that came out in early March about how the Russians were stepping up their efforts to stoke racial tensions by turning more of their attention to white supremacist groups, in addition to their effort before to incite groups on the left. And, you know, this feels particularly relevant because right now we have the reaction to the police killing of George Floyd. I mean, does this square with your understanding of how Russia operates, like what it wants to do in the U.S. in terms of sowing discord, destabilizing the U.S.?
Yes, look, unfortunately, this is a long history of Russian and then before that Soviet involvement in our racial divisions. We saw Russia or the Soviet Union at that point doing similar things going back as far as the 20s and 30s in really trying to exploit racial tensions, segregation, Jim Crow laws, put a spotlight on the plight of African Americans in the U.S. You know, there was a lot of action on the part of the Soviet authorities to invite over prominent African Americans, most notably Paul Robeson, the famous singer, and to, you know, basically showcase him and many others in the Soviet Union to, you know, put a very unflattering spotlight back on the U.S. where he was, you know, very much discriminated against. And during the civil rights movement, stirring things up as well. The point, however, is that Russia doesn't invent any of these divisions. They just try to exploit them, to use them, and to amplify them. So it's like you're saying, it's stoking discord. They don't sow it in the first place, they're stoking it. And, you know, I think we have to be very careful not to attribute, you know, everything that we're seeing to them at all. I mean, they'll be amplifying it and putting a spotlight on it. But, you know, I have to say that all the way around the world right now, the United States is not looking in a very good light. You know, we've seen protests and solidarity with the death of Mr. Floyd in London, in the United Kingdom, in places like Berlin, all over the world media. There's a spotlight being very cast very harshly on the United States and the state of race relations and the treatment of minorities and the inequalities in our society. And so, I mean, the larger message from this is that if we don't want Russia and others to exploit this, we have to deal with it ourselves. And so, you know, the Russians or Putin and others are able to deflect away from their own mismanagement by putting the spotlight on us, you know, and really pointing, you know, a finger at US behavior to basically tell their own population, as well as, you know, larger international populations, look, the United States, it sets itself up here as some kind of beacon and always on a pedestal of, you know, moral values, and look what they're actually doing. I mean, Putin has made, you know, kind of quite an art out of pointing out our own deficiencies and hubris, but as a way, again, of deflecting away from domestic events.
And I think you're right. I mean, I think it is such an important point to underscore that you made, that there are real divisions here, that police violence is real, racism is real, and the tensions here are real, and that Russia's power is really in exploiting the existing real divisions. And you've touched on why it serves them well, one, for example, being that it deflects attention away from their own mismanagement. But what is the ultimate goal here for Russia with these types of activities?
Well, in terms of the United States, Russia, and before that the Soviet Union, has seen us since, of course, the end of World War II as the main adversary. And, you know, so much of their intelligence system has been built up in opposition to us. There's been a lot of, you know, domestic repression, and, you know, some of the tactics that they've used at home, they've kind of honed into, you know, foreign policy tools as well. Very much like we're just talking about now, of kind of stoking discord and, you know, pitting people against each other. They do that at home and the domestic front as well, to split up the opposition to Putin, weaken it, and, you know, have them fighting among themselves. But the main object all the way through this has been to neutralize the United States as any kind of threat. Now, we may think, well, this is ridiculous, because since the end of the Cold War, and certainly from the 1990s onwards, successive US governments, you know, going back to Reagan, in fact, when he was trying to get arms control deals with Gorbachev, have been trying to improve the relationship. We've had, you know, previous administrations have literally tried to reset the relationship and put it on a more positive trajectory. We are not in a geopolitical struggle with Russia, and we're certainly not in a system-wide struggle like we were during the Cold War. This is not capitalism versus communism. So what's going on? Well, unfortunately, I think a lot of it is muscle memory, autopilot. You know, for a lot of the Russian security services, there isn't another adversary. They don't see China as a growing threat in the way that the United States does. In fact, you know, they would much rather make sure that they've got their relationship with China on potentially, you know, a strategic partnership trajectory here. You know, certainly they don't want to end up in another confrontation, although there's, you know,
because
some
of how
tensions.
They're intertwined economically to some extent.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, Chinese and Russian relationship is very different from what's been before. They've grown closer, and the Russians do not want to be pitted against China. So in some respects, you know, their system has just become so attuned to seeing us as the adversary, us as the enemy, and, you know, basically coming up with things that they can do to bring us down to size, to neutralize us, and to make it impossible for us to have some kind of coherent policy against them. So this is what this is all about. It's about you know, cutting off the US as a kind of an international player, and having the United States so weakened at home, fighting, you know, among ourselves domestically, so that we can't, you know, basically launch any kind of action against them. In their view, they see all of our capabilities and think that, well, at any point we could become a threat, so better to get us neutralized.
Do you think that this has the potential to even more broadly question the sustainability of Western democracies? And I know that's a really big question, but I feel like it's a question that people have been asking themselves more frequently now, is just really whether or not our Western-style system of democracy and capitalism is really sustainable, really the beacon that we have put it forward to be.
Well, nothing's sustainable if you just try to kind of keep it in one place all of the time. So, I mean, if something doesn't evolve and adapt and change as time goes on, then of course it's not sustainable. I think, you know, what the Russians are trying to say is that they have an alternate system, a bit like China as well. But they don't have a coherent ideology. There's all kinds of deep ingrained inequities in their system as well, a great deal of unfairness. I mean, the one thing that Putin does, though, that is, you know, quite distinct here, is he recognizes that internal divisions are a huge source of weakness. And that the reason that the Russian Empire fell apart and then the Soviet Union fell apart was because of deep-seated divisions inside their own society. In this case, it was all of the different ethnic groups within the Soviet Union, the individual republics that later became states, that all had, you know, different ways in which they wanted to see the Soviet Union change. Inside of Russia itself, although most of the population is, you know, at least nominally 80% ethnic Russian, nominally Russian Orthodox, you know, a good 20% of the population are minorities, religious minorities and ethnic minorities. And Putin wants to give them a kind of a deep kind of sense of belonging to Russia writ large, because he doesn't want to see the Russian Federation dissolve and go the same way as the Soviet Union, the Russian Empire. So he actively courts people from different ethnic groups and religions. He does not bait on the basis of race or religion. You know, he tries to be also kind of careful when it comes to gender. So there's all these kinds of things where he's super careful because he's trying to create this sense of unity. When he goes after opposition, he goes after those with, you know, kind of much smaller bases of support, ones that he can kind of demonize without risking, you know, upheaval on a larger scale. So there's a lesson for that in there somewhere. As he stokes divisions in other countries, he does try to do the exact opposite at home. And I think, you know, that's a message we should be taking away and thinking about. You know, if he thinks that having these divisions and polarization at home is really dangerous, you know, kind of then it's clear that he's trying to do something to us, which, you know, only has a kind of very malign intent.
And can you draw a through line from that to specifically the 2020 presidential election? I mean, is there one, like, or is that a distinct effort in terms of interfering with our electoral process?
There's two things to bear in mind here. One is the interference, which you just mentioned, which is, you know, when you're trying to get into the electoral systems to change the vote in some way. And, you know, we saw them attempting to do that back in 2016, but there's no evidence that they actually did succeed in changing the vote. You know, maybe that they were just trying to signal us that they could if they wanted to. They might have been, you know, sort of testing out for, you know, future even. But obviously, they also wanted to make people feel very frightened about the integrity of their vote. So there was, you know, kind of intent, even if they didn't actually do it, the intent was there to get people worried about their ability to vote in safety and security and to cast the vote that they wanted to. But we've tackled that, you know, since then. We've done an awful lot as a system, a political system, to make it difficult for the Russians to do that again at the state and local government as well as the federal level. The area where we're most vulnerable is in the influence side, which is, you know, what many of us refer to as hacking the minds of trying to influence opinion. And, you know, what we can see there, you know, they did this in 2016, was hacking and releasing of emails to sow discord, pit people against each other, kind of operations, you know, that put a lot of disinformation about people, creating false personas, you know, trying to stir up various groups on, you know, different sides of the most divisive issues. You know, we could see them doing, you know, this kind of thing again, I think, to be honest, given the state of play now with all of the protests and the clashes that we're seeing, all they have to do is really put the spotlight on that, show it on their own televisions, you know, use RT, Sputnik, their own propaganda outlets to, again, broadcast what's happening here. You know, we need the social media companies to really do something about this as well. But again, we also have to be very careful about not blowing it out of more proportion, because we do the Russians work for them when, you know, we get this idea that they're everywhere, that they're stirring everything up. They actually like us to think that, because again, that's part of the whole idea that we're helpless here in the United States, that we have somehow lost control and that a foreign entity is trying to manipulate us in some way. So we have to be very careful about it when we're talking about it. I mean, the first thing is dealing with our own problems, and that will make it much more difficult for the Russians to actually do anything. In fact, might create the incentives for them to, you know, move off on a different path. I mean, over time, we've really got to think long and hard about how to get off this confrontational trajectory with Russia. There's really no point to it beyond the inevitable and obvious issue of arms control, where we do still have to deal with the fact that we still have these superpower nuclear arsenals trained at each other. There are so many other ways in which this relationship could change in a more positive way, but it'll just take an awful lot of effort. And of course, we've got to first make it difficult for the Russians to think that they're getting any traction with any of these influence operations and this, you know, idea of trying to delegitimize our system.
Well, while it is definitely the responsibility is on all of us, as you say, you also point to social media companies, there is concern about how much they are directly, and you even raised this yourself during the impeachment hearings, how much, you know, Russian narratives are getting into the narratives of our own lawmakers, of the people who hold powerful positions here, especially when you were warning during the impeachment proceedings that that advancing this narrative that Ukraine interfered in the 2016 election is a fictional narrative that benefits Russia. You know, recently, Florida Senator Marco Rubio was appointed the acting intelligence chair after Senator Burr had to step down, and he warned his GOP counterparts against furthering Russian disinformation by, as they investigate Hunter Biden's role at the Ukrainian energy company Burisma. I mean, would you give the same warning about that line of inquiry?
Yes, and I do think that that was very important by Senator Rubio. He clearly is somebody who gets the situation. I know he's been very much engaged in this, you know, behind the scenes, and he understands, you know, what the Russians and others might try to do there to take advantage of what really is domestic political opposition research. You know, when we have our own dirty, dishonest politics, let's just be frank about it. We've got our own, you know, super PACs that are running around with, you know, often these are very positive issues that they're trying to promote, but sometimes it's actually just really focused on denigrating another political candidate. You know, when our partisan warfare has become so extreme that we see each other as the enemy and don't realize that there are actually external forces that might try to manipulate this, this is when we're really in some jeopardy. So there's an awful lot of risk, I think, of the Russians trying to take advantage of, you know, this domestic fixation on finding dirt on in each other and, you know, trying to manufacture some.
Well, this is also the president's fixation.
Well, my point is that this happens in every election. You know, kind of, we've seen it in previous elections as well, when people, you know, kind of look into everyone's background and try to, you know, put the spotlight on, you know, absolutely everything. So look, there's a risk, you know, for example, on, you just mentioned Burisma, that the Russians, we've already seen that they've been trying to hack in to, you know, various entities that have been associated with this energy company. And, you know, that we've seen them forge documents. You know, we've seen them doing selective releases of documents. They did this in the case of the French election, when President Macron was elected. They hacked into various French accounts and actually forged documents. The only thing is that they hadn't quite realized how the French system works, so they didn't actually release it in a way that was going to be effective, and the French system clamped down on it. And so, you know, this is where we'll have to rely on you and other journalists, you know, to be very careful about how you're presenting this. Because in 2016, everybody fell for the fact that we were essentially all fences of stolen property. You know, everybody was poring over the content of the leaked documents, not asking who leaked them, why were they leaked? You know, why were other, you know, items not leaked? The Germans have just, you know, come out talking about a massive hack that was made into the Bundestag, the German parliamentary emails back in 2015. And what was interesting there is the Russians didn't release the information. And so, you know, there's a lot of head scratching in the German system as to, well, they collected all this information, why didn't they, you know, release it? And, you know, Chancellor Merkel has just spoken out against it. You know, there's all kinds of different ways in which they can manipulate information. And we have to be very clear about who is doing this and why they're doing it and call it out. And again, the real risk is when they're acting, you know, kind of in parallel or mimicking things that domestic actors are doing. But there's a line between domestic actors, you know, wish we'd clean up our own domestic politics. But there's a line that is crossed when it's a foreign country that means us harm that's doing this.
What I think was so striking when you did testify was that you did call it out so directly, that you did call out trying to put the blame on election interference on Ukraine, and also the fact that you were very unflinching, very composed. And I have to wonder if you felt that way during the testimony, because that is such a high stakes position to be in.
Well, I did, to be honest. I mean, I felt like I needed to get that message across because, you know, it's something that really continues to worry me a great deal. You know, there are many people who know the same things that I do, you know, who share the same concerns. But, you know, we're not always given a voice to be able to express these to a much broader audience. And, you know, I certainly wasn't seeking out to be in that position. But once I was in it, I wanted to be able to get that message across that, you know, a lot of times we're doing it to ourselves. And, you know, when we get so caught up in domestic politics and we see, you know, literally, I'm often making the analogy to kind of, I don't play video games very often, but I did once play Mortal Kombat. I didn't do very well at it, actually. But this whole idea of annihilating your opponent and, you know, having, you know, political figure as an avatar, you know, just to kind of wipe everybody else out. I mean, if this is what our politics has come to, we're extraordinarily vulnerable. Because, I mean, here we are in the middle of a pandemic and we've had, you know, these dreadful examples of just continuous episodes of police brutality and the, you know, terrible traumas over and over and over again to our African-American and other minority communities. We need to be dealing with this as a country. We need to be acting like the United States. And when we become pitted against each other and we can't see past partisan divides, you know, we become fragile, we become brittle. And this is exactly what Putin himself learned from the collapse of the Soviet Union, his own reading of his own history and the collapse of the Russian Empire. And he talks about this all the time. And yet he's, you know, he's quite comfortable in turning that back against us. You know, and our own politicians need to have that same sense of awareness that, frankly, Vladimir Putin does and be asking ourselves, what are we doing to the United States here? What are we allowing to happen here? And when we see our political opponent as an enemy and as somebody who has to be destroyed, at least in their reputation, if not physically, we've crossed a line ourselves. And that was the message I was trying to get across, because I felt that most acutely during, you know, the whole testimony, that, you know, I and all of my colleagues had come in as fact witnesses, and we came in because we'd taken an oath to serve the country. And, you know, the vast majority of us were non-partisan officials, you know, who were willing to serve, you know, for the greater good of the country. And yet we were being pitted as objects in this bitter fight on a partisan basis. And, you know, that was, you know, really something that, you know, everybody could see unfolding, you know, before their eyes.
It's such a difficult position to be in, but also even after you speak out, everybody, it feels, pays some degree of personal cost. I mean, I read that you had experienced threats, death threats, even around your testimony. I mean, what kind of personal cost do you feel like you've had to pay in as a result of doing that?
Well, look, those are not personal costs that compare to anything like, you know, we're seeing with, you know, people like George Floyd, you know, losing their life. I mean, you've got to put this all into, you know, perspective here. I mean, I'll be frank, of course, it was, you know, disconcerting to say the least to, you know, get threats. And a lot of it was on the internet. So I frankly have just, you know, pulled myself out of all of that. But what I did get, though, I have to say this, is I got hundreds of letters from across the United States from people who were just as concerned as I am and as you are and everyone else is about the state of our democracy right now. A lot of people worrying about the partisan politics, the deep polarization, the divides that we see growing up everywhere, the inequality, the opportunity gaps, and wanting to see, you know, people pulling together to pull, you know, the country out of this crisis that it's in. And literally hundreds of letters. And out of all of those letters, there was only one that was, you know, somewhat negative. And that was just, you know, somebody who was expressing that they didn't particularly like the way that I, you know, described something, which was totally fair enough. And, you know, I read the letter very carefully and wrote back to the person, said, hey, if you're ever in DC, look me up and we can talk about this. But I was really heartened by these letters because it shows that there is really a great desire that often just gets lost in, you know, all of the stories about the terrible things that are happening, of people to actually do something different. I also got a very strong impression because I got letters from people of all kinds of party affiliations, Republican, Democrats, people who got called themselves independent, people who said they were supporters of the president, you know, a load of people basically just saying, we'd like to see something different here. And we would like to see the country, you know, move forward, people having an honest, transparent discussion. Again, the facts, information that isn't politicized. So I think people were really watching the testimony with a great deal of attention and wanting to see more, not just about, you know, this particular situation, but want to see more of people grappling, you know, with the problems that are facing us.
Well, you mentioned that you felt that with regard to our election security and our voting systems, that we've potentially done some good work in terms of securing those. What's your outlook on how successful Russian efforts to stoke discord? What's your outlook on the likelihood that we will have a safe and fair election this time around with accurate information and the right intentions? Do you know what I mean? It just feels, I don't know where we're at.
Well, look, I think our systems are secure. I believe that you can vote quite safely by mail. I've had to quite often because of travel have a mail-in ballot. You know, I have no reason to ever think that this was a particular problem. I have family and friends all the way across the country who routinely vote by mail. So I think, you know, we can be assured that that is a safe way. And I think if people, you know, kind of are paying attention to their conscience, they're just paying attention to what's happening in the country, they, you know, do a lot more of reading up on candidates. And, you know, I think that people can, if they're, you know, being very careful about the information that they consume, they can be, you know, sure that they, you know, can vote securely and safely. One thing I do want to say, though, is that it's not just a question of this election or any election. I mean, the one thing in a democracy, and this is actually what does make America very strong, is everyone has individual agency. There are so many things that people can do to change the situation that they're in at a local, you know, community and state and national level. I've been trying to work closely over the last couple of months with something called the National Commission on Military, National and Public Service, which was set up by Congress back in January 2017 to do a sort of a two-year study on service within the United States. And they've found a huge desire of people from all walks of life across the entire country to want to do something to serve the country at all kinds of different levels, maybe joining the military, joining in state and local government, the federal government less so, unfortunately, because there's so much distrust in the federal government that we have to change, but also of doing all kinds of voluntary work, be it with their church, you know, kind of local community centres, through schools and universities. And, you know, the goal of the commission is to try to kind of make service like this universal, even if it's voluntary, and to make, you know, people think about being able to do something like this, because next year is the anniversary of John F. Kennedy's call to service. And so, you know, I just like to, you know, say to people listening to this, there's so much that we can do. We can go and help out our local public library, you know, where they help people, and it's going to be very necessary now, you know, to get back on their feet to find jobs, food banks, you know, all kinds of, through the churches and, you know, trying to work with the homeless. This is a period of acute crisis where everyone needs to pull in. One person, even at a congressional, Senate, or at the level of the presidency, is not going to solve all of our problems. And I think we've seen through the pandemic our public health and workers in the front lines in hospitals, fire brigades. You know, I know that we're having all of these debates now about the police, but at the community level, I mean, I've seen, you know, acts of great courage and kindness by, you know, police in, you know, my locality. We have to all work together to address these problems that, you know, that we're seeing in front of us here. There's also our governors and our mayors. There's so much that everyone can do to really change this situation. And voting is only one part of it. It's extraordinarily important, especially now you and I, Mina, talking. This is the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment of women getting the vote. And I really firmly believe that everyone should use their vote. Not voting is a choice as well, about not going out there and voting your conscience, or, you know, voting because you want to see some change. So I think there's a lot of things people can do, from voting to volunteering. And even people who are in really dire circumstances can volunteer. There's lots of people who man food banks who've lost their own jobs. You know, I know that from personal experience. And so, you know, everybody can do their bit. And that's the only way that we're going to pull out of this. And that's when Americans are working together and seeing themselves as being part of the same society. I know we've got a lot of things to overcome for everyone to see that. That's when the Russians don't get traction. And that's what Putin learned at home. You know, so, you know, this is kind of what we have to. I know it sounds aspirational and people might be saying, oh, yes, right, that's not going to happen. But we can work on it, and we have to work on it.
Well, Fiona Hill, such a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much. I really appreciated hearing your insights on this. And I do leave actually pretty inspired by your optimism.
Well, we have to have optimism. Particularly at a time like this. I mean, we have to, because there are ways of getting out of it. And look, I talk, you know, a lot with colleagues and others. And, you know, I think about what my family went through in World War One, World War Two, you know, what so many people went through here in the same period. You know, we had in the United States, we had the civil rights movement. We had all of the, you know, terrible things that, you know, happened at so many other points, you know, Vietnam and the aftermath. We can do this. We can change things. We really can. And I'm very optimistic. I mean, I came to the United States 30 years ago, and I remain very optimistic in the country. It's why I wanted to become a citizen, why I wanted to serve. And I have no regrets at any time about any of those decisions. And, you know, I think all of us can pull together. We really can.
It feels like you really do think a lot about your family's situation, your parents, when you are thinking of ways to ground ourselves in this time, almost.
Yeah, my dad was homeless as a kid for years. I mean, he was born into such poverty that his older brother had to go and live with relatives because his parents couldn't feed him. And it had a real scar on him, you know, for his whole life. And I mean, his father was out of work for 7 years and, you know, basically subsisting on handouts. But they pulled themselves together, you know, and eventually find a way out of it. But they did that because of a bigger society. You know, they had the St. Vincent de Paul Society from the Catholic Church, the Quakers, who helped the Salvation Army in the UK, you know, which of course we have, you know, here, you know, in the US as well. The Methodist Church, there was lots of, you know, faith-based institutions as well as other social entities. A local farmer who gave my granddad work now and again, and, you know, then would give him some food in return for work. It was all kinds of things that it was, they didn't do it on their own. And I mean, that's kind of what we're seeing now with COVID-19. We have to pull together as communities to help people out of this as well. And, you know, that was kind of the lesson that came out of my family. My parents always tried to pay back. I mean, if my mom wasn't sitting at home in the UK now, sheltering in place because she's 85, you know, obviously in a vulnerable age, she would be at her local church volunteering with the food bank and the crisis centre. You know, so, and, you know, she, and that, you know, place that she volunteers in is filled with people who are elderly or people who have often not been in long-term, you know, full-time employment themselves, but want to help their community. And I know that the United States is exactly the same because I see it in my in-laws and, you know, other relatives doing the same thing.
Well, Fiona Hill, thank you.
No, thank you so much, Mina. It's a great pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to the weekly broadcast of World Affairs. It's produced in partnership with KQED. I'm Philip Yun. That was KQED's Mina Kim in conversation with Fiona Hill. She was top advisor on Russia under three different presidents. Next, we're going to take a closer look at how Vladimir Putin governs at home. As Russia suffers through its own severe COVID-19 outbreak, Putin is solidifying his power. He scheduled a nationwide vote for July 1st on a constitutional amendment. And if it passes, it would allow him to stay in power for another 16 years. Of course, Putin has been consolidating power for years, all while profiting from it personally. Catherine Belton has documented it all and talks with Ray Suarez.
Catherine Belton is an investigative journalist for Reuters and a former Moscow correspondent for the Financial Times. Her new book is Putin's People, How the KGB Took Back Russia and Then Took On the West. With incredible access to Kremlin insiders, oligarchs, and former intelligence operatives, Belton reveals how Vladimir Putin and a small group of KGB officers rose to power and subverted Russia's economy and legal system and extended the Kremlin's reach into the United States and Europe. Catherine Belton, welcome to World Affairs.
Thanks so much for having me on.
The material you include in this book is probably distributed in a lot of different places, but you've done the world a great favor by putting it all into one place. It is amazing.
Thank you.
I didn't even know a lot of this stuff was findoutable, if that's a word. Are the Russian sources that allow you to, in effect, almost moment by moment, put together the rise of Putin available to the public, or were there sources that had to be cultivated, developed in Russia that would not normally be available?
Yeah, that's a good question. I guess I was very lucky in the sense that I worked for many years as a correspondent in Moscow, mostly writing about business, including 7 years for the Financial Times, which gives you a great deal of privileged access to people. And you do get to know people and they come to trust you. I probably wouldn't have been able to put it together had I not sort of had the experience of working at the FT previously, had I not been able to already establish a rapport with many of my sources before I embarked on working on the book. So yeah, I was very lucky, I think, and also lucky in being able to spend a great deal of time trying to put it together.
Take us back to Central Europe, Eastern Germany, around the time of the fall of the Berlin Wall, the fall of the GDR regime. Who was Vladimir Putin then? And were there already signs or intimations that he could become, that he had the tools to become, the man he is today?
Well, I'm not sure that people would think he had the tools then, but Dresden in East Germany, where he served from 1985 onwards, was certainly a training ground for what we see today. He was a mid-level KGB officer then, but he was quite senior in the ranks of that station. He was the main liaison officer between the KGB and the Stasi, and actually what he was up to were actually quite a lot of nefarious activities to try and disrupt the West. I think the Russians have always sort of gone to great lengths to kind of portray his time there as sort of him kind of being in a backwater where he did nothing apart from drink beer and write senseless reports. But actually that wasn't really the case. And then they went to great lengths to sort of cover up what he and his allies had actually been up to, because they burned all the documents before protesters could get to them, or they shipped a huge kind of truckloads out to Moscow as well before East German protesters could get to them. So they did sort of embark on a great cover-up campaign. But what I did find when I was speaking to sort of some of his ex-colleagues from the Stasi and from the KGB when he was there, was that he was sort of very actively involved then in smuggling of high technology. There was a Western-imposed embargo on imports of technology into the Soviet Union then for dual use that could be used for military means. But Putin and his friends were sort of very ably setting up front companies to sort of smuggle some of this technology through Dresden and then into the Soviet Union. Dresden was a hub for this type of activity. It had a big kind of computer factory there where they were cloning the IBM and up to other such activities. But he was also, according to two of his former colleagues, actually also kind of deeply involved in active measures against the West. He was, according to one defector, he'd been a handler for a very notorious German neo-Nazi who for a while was released into the West and then came back to East Germany and helped stoke the rise of the far right there. He'd also been trying to kind of acquire, according to this one defector, he'd been trying to acquire poison which didn't leave a trace, and he'd been trying to kind of persuade a professor into handing this over to him by planting pornographic material on him. We're not sure whether this operation ever got off the ground, but this is sort of one such incident a defector has told of. So I think it was a training ground for him, but it was also kind of provided him in lessons that he would sort of keep with him as he rose through the ranks in Russia after the Soviet collapse, because not only were they sort of taking activities to disrupt the West, but they were also preparing, his particular faction of the KGB were preparing for the Soviet collapse. They knew that there was a risk of collapse of the communist regime. And so all the while they began siphoning cash and assets into front companies through a network of close allies along the lines of activities we also see today in how he runs the Russian economy today.
You give us formidable detail explaining the dissolution, the scramble for assets, the scramble for power and position. There were probably, I'm going to argue, a fair number of men who liked their chances in the tumult of the early 90s Russia. Yet it was Putin who quietly, slowly, and very strategically climbed the greasy pole and was very clever about cultivating the powerful and holding on to increasing levels of power and influence himself. A fair read?
Yes, indeed. That's a good read indeed. I think part of his rise has to do with chance. He just happened to be in the right place at the right time, but he wouldn't have got to the position he did get to had he not had a great deal of support from within the security services, had he not been sort of also very able at sort of being charming. Sort of one ex-senior KGB officer told me that he learned his lessons well in KGB school. He was very charming on one-on-one conversations. He really was very able in kind of trying to win the trust of his interlocutors. And most importantly of all, at the time when he did come to power, obviously he sort of spent the first half of the 90s, he was in the shadows. And then after 96, he moved to Moscow, where he very quietly rose through the ranks almost unnoticeably. But he was always occupying very senior positions very quickly within the Kremlin. And he was trusted. And he was trusted by the Yeltsin family who were running the country then, in part because he was so unassuming. He seemed so unambitious at the time when sort of Russian politics was a real kind of den of vipers. Everyone was sort of trying to grab what they could. And here was Putin, who was just saying, well, you know, I would like to serve my country. And at one stage, I think it was 1997, he'd reached the rank of deputy Kremlin chief of staff. And he came to Valentin Yumashev, who was the Kremlin chief of staff in those days, and Boris Yeltsin's son-in-law to be. And he came to him and he said, look, I think I've done my bit now. You know, I've sort of done all I can. I've served my country, and I don't think really there's much more I can do. Maybe it's time for me to resign. And it was a very rare thing to hear in those days, and it only sort of burnished his credentials more in the eyes of Yumashev, the Kremlin chief of staff. And actually, shortly after, he was promoted to an even higher position, to first deputy Kremlin chief of staff, which is where he first came into contact with Yeltsin. But again, I think his rise would not have really happened had not Russia sort of plunged into chaos in August 98. There was a terrible financial crisis which wiped out the population's savings and also really did weaken Yeltsin. Yeltsin probably would have been in a position to anoint his own guy, his successor. He would have been in a position to anoint a sort of a so-called liberal to sort of continue the Russian reform process, but his standing was so diminished by the financial crisis that he was sort of forced to turn to sort of the security services to kind of first act as his prime minister. But at the same time, Yeltsin's family were facing this prosecution. They were facing increasing legal threats over their use of credit cards that had been given to them by a Swiss construction firm that had won a multi-billion-dollar contract to reconstruct the Kremlin. And it looked like these credit cards were kickbacks. And the sums involved were minuscule compared to the corruption scandals that we see today, which involve billions of dollars. In this case, it was a couple of hundred thousand, but it was enough in those days in Yeltsin's weakened position to pose a real threat, because it was against the law for anyone in senior office to hold a foreign bank account. And they were terrified about sort of where it might lead. And so they needed a strongman. They needed someone from the security services who could protect them. And Putin was very able at demonstrating his loyalty. Putin was portraying himself as being a liberal. The Yeltsin family really believed he was one of them. They thought he was young, he was progressive. He basically told the Yeltsin family that he thought he'd only be doing it for a few years and then he'd step down. Was it always a game? Or perhaps he might have believed that he would only be in that position for a few years. But I think the KGB people around him who came to power with him were certainly not going to let the chance go. Once they'd come to power, he was going to be in it for as long as possible.
Vladimir Putin is portrayed in the United States as a wily chess player, a master strategist, a man who knows where all the bodies are buried and has his fingers in innumerable pies. He is built up into quite a figure by the storytellers on this side of the Atlantic. In the middle third of your book, you show us a man who is at times unsure, a man who at times oversees serial failures to deliver on some of the promises and assurances he makes to his allies and more broadly to the people of Russia. How has he managed to float like a cork on seas of discontent, on seas of inability to deliver? How does he cultivate this image of being the master strategist when Russians have seen a fall in their standard of living in many places outside Moscow, seen a fall in their life expectancy, seen foreign adventures that have their young men coming home in body bags and boxes with nothing really that substantial to show for it? It is an amazing thing that Vladimir Putin is still, at this now 20 years in, seen as this wily chess grandmaster, when so much of what he does is basically underwritten by the price of oil and underwritten by the fact that he's, from your telling, the kingpin of an enormous multinational criminal organization.
Yeah, I think basically a lot of his success has had to do with luck, and that's mainly to do with the fact in the first two terms of his presidency, from 2000 to 2008, oil prices did rise considerably. So he did oversee for a while this huge increase in living standards, and the Russians had suffered a great deal under Yeltsin, even though they had a great deal more freedom than they do now in terms of democracy and sort of being able to elect their own leaders and having a choice and having a free media. There was a lot of economic chaos. Their savings were wiped out several times overnight under sort of this very rocky transition to the market. But during the Yeltsin years, the oil price was always incredibly low, where as soon as Putin came to power, it rocketed. You know, it went from sort of like $15 to nearly $100 at one point until it collapsed again in 2008. But there was this huge increase in living standards. And for a while, a lot of the population really approved of what he was doing to sort of rein in any challenges to his power. They approved of Putin's efforts to rein in sort of independent oligarchs who'd been seen as being sort of rapacious and trying to carve out bits of power for themselves during the 90s. So most of the Russian population didn't actually really care when sort of Putin essentially suborned the country's entire legal system so that he could put his political rivals in jail, because most of these political rivals were oligarchs who'd been seen by the population as having kind of unfairly acquired wealth in the 90s. So they were willing to sort of turn a blind eye to this. And even though Putin was presiding essentially over a KGB state where he was able to sort of take over whatever business, or he and his allies could take over whatever business they wanted, you know, most of the population didn't really care because they weren't particularly affected by this. It was only if you were at the highest level, if you owned an oil company or something very strategic that the Kremlin wanted its hands on, that you would be affected. Most people could continue to live their day-to-day lives. There wasn't the same degree of surveillance like there would have been in Soviet times. Like, in ordinary people in Soviet times were kind of felt the eyes of the KGB everywhere, because it was a very sort of political regime. You weren't allowed to speak out even in your kitchen against the state, because there was always a neighbor who was going to tell tales on you. And for a long time in Putin's Russia, that was different. Your interests weren't affected as long as you didn't sort of directly cross his guy's strategic interests. But that has changed a great deal now that sort of Putin's luck is kind of running out. He's had a number of tricks up his sleeve, because the great economic boom of the first 2 years of his presidency ran out with a jolt in the 2008 financial crisis. Oil prices recovered, but not to the same degree as before. And so by the time he returned to the presidency again in 2012, I think he was facing protests. People didn't want to see him come back. The economy was flagging. saying he wasn't able to deliver the same hike in living standards. So what did he do? He pulled the greatest trick out of his sleeve ever, and that was returning Crimea to the Russian Federation. It was the annexation of Crimea. Obviously, to some degree, that was triggered by this great tug of war for Ukraine between the East and West, and all the protests that led to the toppling of the Kremlin's man in Ukraine, Viktor Yanukovych. But Putin seized that moment as an opportunity to burnish his patriotic credentials. He was restoring Russia's pride. And then forever after, all his foreign adventures in Syria and elsewhere in the Middle East have also kind of played into that sort of pattern that sort of Putin has been restoring Russia's standing on the world stage after all this humiliation after the Soviet collapse. And that sort of plays very well into sort of this former superpower mentality. I mean, obviously, a lot of Russians are nostalgic for the days of Soviet empire, but only to the degree that their sort of own pocket isn't in being impacted by it. And really, he's kind of running out of tricks now, because the oil price is once again in incredibly low territory, because Putin has sort of relied on using the Russian economy. He's relied on taking over strategic cash flows to shore up his own power and to project Russian power abroad. He hasn't really cared about diversifying the Russian economy, about making it less dependent on oil and gas. And so now that prices are low again, he's in trouble. Of course, they've managed to save up a kind of rainy day fund to bail out companies during times of crisis like today's pandemic. But it's not going to last very long if oil prices remain at their current lows for longer than a year. Some economists have said he might run out of oil reserves to bail out the Russian economy sort of within the next year and a half, 2 years. And meanwhile, there's the pandemic marauding around the economy. Like other countries, most of the economy has been shut down. Unlike other sort of Western economies, Putin hasn't been giving out handouts to small and medium businesses, because I think they realize their funds are finite. So people are expecting this sort of great wave of bankruptcies for small and medium businesses. People are also expecting the infighting within the elite will escalate, because there's only a finite amount of reserves that can be used to bail out even the big companies. So they'll be fighting over that. So he's really kind of entering into uncharted crisis territory, where all the short-sightedness of his strategy is really going to sort of come to the fore, because it's one thing to sort of spend your money on trying to be a superpower, on trying to look like this great Machiavelli who's dividing and disrupting the West, when you've got sort of a full stash of cash at home. But when they run out, when it's running out due to your kind of short-sightedness in not really kind of preparing your own economy and preferring to sort of siphon cash from businesses to spend on foreign adventures rather than sort of trying to become a global power through boosting competition in your own economy, through boosting the strength of your own economy. I mean, this is when it kind of everything starts to kind of hit pay dirt now for Putin. He's going to sort of reap what he sowed in terms of the short-sightedness of his tactics, because I think the vulnerability of the Russian economy is going to become very clear.
One quick close. You talk about these converging trends, and certainly if you're in Magnitogorsk or Vladivostok, you can't eat greatness. Greatness is great, I guess, but the fact that Russia now possesses the Crimea again may not take the place of a battered ruble, international pariah status, people dying of COVID. And at the same time, President Putin engineering a constitutional jerry-rig that allows him to stay in office years and years longer. Are we approaching some kind of end game, even as Vladimir Putin is looking outside his own borders to try to, we're told, continue to interfere in America's domestic life?
I think, you know, it's that perennial question. It's very difficult to answer because even though I think the economic risks are rising greatly for Putin now, I think he hasn't had to deal with oil prices at such low levels before, combined with the sort of double whammy of the pandemic. I think we will see the consequences of this only perhaps in a year's time, when the economic kind of fallout has had time to ripple through the economy. I mean, he has had been very lucky so far in sort of being able to sort of preside over people with a relatively better living standards compared to the 90s. But I think when that starts falling away, we're going to see whether the Russians are prepared to stand up and protest or not. And obviously, he's sort of benefited greatly from being able to essentially wipe out the political competition. They can only kind of reach the public through the internet. So we're really going to sort of see this sort of testing time for Putin. You can tell that he's nervous, and I think probably he's looking quite warily as well at what's happening at the United States at the moment, because these protests against Trump could also inspire Russians to sort of come out and make a stand as well. I mean, we haven't really seen anything like this before, and the Russians do watch very closely what's happening in the US. You can see very clearly that he's nervous in that sort of immediately, I mean, at the moment they've been sort of one-man protesters, including a journalist who've been locked up and jailed for 15 days just for holding a one-man protest. So obviously they don't want any contagion in this sense from the West either. So they're kind of watching it very, very nervously. We're really going to see kind of the crunch time, really. And I think it's also another reason why he's rushing through this vote on allowing him to stay in power till 2036. Initially, there'd been talk of holding the vote in September, when the virus really had dissipated, when there was no kind of risk to human health. But now they're rushing ahead, even though the virus level are still growing in Russia. They're rushing ahead with holding the vote on July the 1st, because really it's kind of a race against time. At the moment, he can probably kind of just about maybe squeak it, even though his popularity levels are falling. His standing in the population is now at the lowest level since he came to power 20 years ago, but it's still over 50%. It's still 59%, if you believe the official figures, although another poll puts trust in him at just 25%. But I think they believe that they can squeak it. Maybe there'll be a bit of kind of ballot stuffing along the way, because there normally is a little bit, but they might just get away with it. But if they leave it any longer, then once the sort of the economic fallout starts to ripple through the economy, I think he'll have much less chance of getting this vote through and being able to stay in power. And probably he'd like to step down by now, but I don't think any of his KGB allies would actually allow him, because they've been through so much and done so much to shore up their power over the last 20 years. It's just far too risky a prospect to hand over to anyone.
That's Catherine Belton. Her new book is Putin's People. She's a special correspondent for Reuters and was Moscow correspondent for the Financial Times. And this book, if you're interested in the recent history of the end of the Soviet Union and the new Russian Federation, I recommend it to you heartily. Catherine Belton, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much for having me on. Thank you.
You've been listening to World Affairs. We just heard from Catherine Belton talking about her new book, Putin's People, How the KGB Took Back Russia and Then Took the West. Earlier, we heard from Fiona Hill talk about Russia's interference in U.S. elections. To hear this program or any other episode, you can download our podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Search for World Affairs, that's one word. While you're there, please leave us a rating. It helps others find our program. World Affairs is a nonprofit organization. Please consider supporting this program by donating at worldaffairs.org. World Affairs is produced in partnership with KQED, with funding from TPG Capital. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. Jared Sport and Teresa Katsourilis produced this episode. Ray Suarez and Mina Kim co-hosted. Allegra Diamond provided research assistance. Joanne Jennings is our executive producer. I'm Philip Yun. Thank you for joining us.